credentials in order to be taken seriously about police misconduct. I started writing my complaint to the Atlanta Police Department, determined not to reveal that I was an attorney. I detailed all of my concerns. I found Bureau of Justice Statistics reports that black men were 8 times more likely to be killed by the police than whites. The problem would get worse as some states passed stand-your-ground laws empowering armed citizens who weren't even trained to use lethal force as well. Before I knew it, I had typed close to 9 pages outlining all the things I thought had gone wrong. For 2 pages, I detailed the completely illegal search of the vehicle and the absence of probable cause. I even cited about 6 cases. I read over the complaint and realized that I'd done everything but say, "I'm a lawyer." I filed my complaint with the police department and tried to forget about the incident, but I couldn't. What bothered me most was the moment when the officer drew his weapon and I thought about running. I was a 28-year-old lawyer who had worked on police misconduct cases, who knew to speak calmly to the officer when he threatened to shoot me. When I thought about what I would have done when I was 16 years old, or 19, or even 24, I was scared to realize that I might have run. The more I thought about it, the more concerned I became about all the young black boys and men in that neighborhood. Did they know not to run? Did they know to stay calm and say, "It's okay"? I began to feel embarrassed that I hadn't asserted more control during the encounter. I hadn't told the officers that what they were doing was illegal. Should I have said something? Despite the work I'd done assisting people on death row, I questioned how prepared I was to do really difficult things. I even started having second thoughts about going to Alabama to start a law office. My complaint made it through the review process at the Atlanta Police Department. Every few weeks, I'd get a letter explaining that the police officers had done nothing wrong, and that police work is very difficult. Finally, the deputy chief agreed to meet with me. I had asked for an apology and suggested training cops to avoid similar incidents. He nodded politely as I explained what had happened. When I finished, he apologized, but I suspected that he just wanted me to leave. He promised that the officers would be required to do some extra homework on community relations. I didn't feel better. My caseload was getting crazy. The lawyers defending the Gadsden City Jail finally admitted that Mr. Ruffin's rights had been violated and that he had been illegally denied his asthma medicine. We won a decent settlement for Mr. Ruffin's family, so they would at least receive some financial help. By then, my death penalty docket was full. I had no time to make war with the Atlanta police when I had clients facing execution. Still, I couldn't stop thinking about how dangerous and unfair the situation was and how I'd done nothing wrong. And what if I had had drugs in my car? I would have been arrested even if the police had entered the car illegally. Would I get an attorney who would take such a claim seriously? Would a judge believe that I'd done nothing wrong? Would they believe someone who was just like me but happened not to be a lawyer? Would they believe someone who was unemployed or had a prior criminal record? I started giving talks to youth groups, churches, and community organizations about the challenges of being criminalized for being poor or a person of color and dealing with the presumption of guilt. I spoke at local meetings and argued that police could improve public safety without abusing people, that law enforcers and people in power should still be held accountable for their actions. After one talk at a small African-American church in a poor rural county in Alabama, I was approached by an older black man in a wheelchair. He was wearing an old brown suit. I had noticed him looking at me intensely throughout my presentation. A young boy who was about 12 wheeled him over to me, probably his grandson. "Do you know what you're doing?" the old man asked. I tried to smile through my confusion. I think so. He cut me off and said loudly, "I'll tell you what you're doing. You're beating the drum for justice." He had an impassioned look on his face. He said it again emphatically. "You've got to beat the drum for justice." He leaned back in his chair and I stopped smiling. Something about what he said had sobered me. I answered him softly, "Yes, sir." He looked at me sympathetically and waved me closer. Then he spoke very quietly, almost a whisper, but with a fierceness that was unforgettable. "You see this scar on the top of my head?" He tilted his head to show me. "I got that scar in Greene County, Alabama, trying to register to vote in 1964. You see this scar on the side of my head?" He turned his head to the left, and I saw a 4-inch scar just above his right ear. "I got that scar in Mississippi demanding civil rights." His voice got stronger. He tightened his grip on my arm and lowered his head some more. "You see that mark?" There was a dark circle at the base of his skull. "I got that bruise in Birmingham after the Children's Crusade." He leaned back and looked at me intensely. "People look at me. They think I'm some old man with scars, cuts, and bruises." For the first time, I noticed that his eyes were wet with tears. He placed his hands on his head. "These aren't my scars, cuts, and bruises. These are my medals of honor." He stared at me for a long moment, wiped his eyes, and nodded to the boy who wheeled him away. I stood there with a lump in my throat, staring after him. After a moment, I realized that the time to open the Alabama office had come. Chapter 3. Trials and Tribulation. After months of frustration, failure, and growing public scorn, Sheriff Thomas Tate, ABI lead investigator Simon Benson, and the district attorney's investigator Larry Eichner decided to arrest Walt McMillan based on Ralph Meyer's allegation. They hadn't yet investigated Mr. McMillan, so they decided to arrest him on a minor pretextual charge while they built their bigger case. During Meyer's strange testimonial, the suggestion that Mr. McMillan might also have sexually assaulted him arose. Alabama law had outlawed non-procreative sex, so officials planned to arrest Mr. McMillan on those charges. On June 7, 1987, Sheriff Tate led an army of more than a dozen officers to a backcountry road. When they found Walter's truck, they drew their weapons, forced him from his vehicle, and surrounded him. Tate told him that he was under arrest. When Walter frantically asked the sheriff what he had done, the sheriff told him that he was being charged with sodomy. Walter told the sheriff that he did not understand the meaning of the word. When the sheriff explained the charge in crude terms, Walter was incredulous and couldn't help but laugh at the notion. This provoked Tate, who unleashed a torrent of racial slurs and threats. Walter would report for years that all he heard throughout his arrest were insults and threats of lynching. "We're going to keep all of you from running around with these white girls. I ought to take you off and hang you like we done in Mobile," Tate reportedly told Walter, referring to a haunting case in Mobile from only a few years before, in which the Ku Klux Klan had lynched a young African-American man named Michael Donald. The threats of lynching terrified Walter. He was also confused. If he was being arrested for raping another man, why were they throwing questions at him about the murder of Rhonda Morrison? Walter vehemently denied both allegations. In response, the officers locked him up. When Ted Pearson, the district attorney of Monroe County, first heard his investigators' flimsy evidence against Walter McMillan, he must have been disappointed. Ralph Meyer's story of the crime was pretty far-fetched. Here is Meyer's account of the murder of Rhonda Morrison. On the day of the murder, Meyer was getting gas. Walter McMillan saw him at the gas station and forced him at gunpoint to get into Walter's truck. Meyer didn't really know Walter before that day. Once in the truck, Walter told Meyer he needed him to drive because Walter's arm was hurt. Meyer protested but had no choice. Walter directed Meyer to drive him to Jackson Cleaners in downtown Monroeville and to wait in the truck while Mr. McMillan went inside alone. After waiting a long time, Meyer drove down the street to a grocery store to buy cigarettes. He returned 10 minutes later. After another long wait, Mr. McMillan finally emerged from the store and returned to the truck. He immediately admitted that he had killed the store clerk. Myers then drove Mr. McMillan back to the gas station so that Myers could retrieve his vehicle. Before Myers left, Walter threatened to kill him if he ever told anyone what he had seen or done. In summary, an African-American man planning a robbery murder in the heart of Monroeville in the middle of the day stops at a gas station and randomly selects a white man to become his accomplice by asking him to drive him to and from the crime scene because his arm is injured. Even though he had been able to drive himself to the gas station where he encountered Myers and to drive his truck home after returning Myers to the gas station. Law enforcement officers knew that Myers' story would be very difficult to prove, so they arrested Walter for sodomy, which served to shock the community and further tarnish Mr. McMillan's reputation. It also gave police an opportunity to bring Walter's truck to the jail for Bill Hooks, a jailhouse informant, to see. Bill Hooks was a young black man with a reputation as a jailhouse snitch. He had been in the county jail on burglary charges at the time Mr. McMillan was arrested. Hooks was promised release from jail and reward money if he could connect Mr. McMillan's truck to the Morrison murder. Hooks eagerly told investigators that he had driven by Jackson Cleaners near the time of the crime and had seen a truck tear away from the cleaners with two men inside. At the jail, Hooks identified Walter's truck as the one he'd seen at the cleaners nearly 6 months earlier. This second witness gave law enforcement officials what they needed to charge Walter McMillan with capital murder in the shooting death of Rhonda Morrison. There was joy and relief in the community. Finally, someone had been charged. Sheriff Tom Tate, the district attorney, and other law enforcement officers were cheered. People who knew Walter, though, found it difficult to believe he could be responsible for a sensational murder. Black residents told Sheriff Tate that he had arrested the wrong man. This was a man who had no history of crime or violence, and robbery just didn't make sense for someone who worked as hard as he did. Tate still had not investigated Mr. McMillan himself, his life or background, or even his whereabouts on the day of the murder. He knew about the affair with Karen Kelly and had heard the rumors that Walter's independence as a black man must mean he was dealing drugs. As it turned out, on the day of the murder, a fish fry had been held at Walter's house. Members of Walter's family spent the day out in front of the house selling food to passersby to raise money for the local church where Evelyn Smith, Walter's sister, was a minister. There were at least a dozen church parishioners at the house all morning with Walter and his family on the day Rhonda Morrison was murdered. Walter didn't have a tree job that day. He had decided to replace the transmission in his truck and called over his mechanic friend, Jimmy Hunter, to help. By 9:30 in the morning, the two men had dismantled Walter's truck, completely removing the transmission. By 11 o'clock, relatives had arrived and had started frying fish and other food to sell. Police reported that the Morrison murder took place around 10:15, 11 miles or so from Mr. McMillan's home, at the same time that a dozen church members were at Walter's home selling food while Walter and Jimmy worked on his truck. In the early afternoon, Ernest Welch, a white man who worked for a local furniture store, arrived to collect money from Walter's mother for a purchase she had made on credit. Welch told the folks gathered at the house that his niece Rhonda had been murdered at Jackson Cleaners that morning. They discussed the shocking news with Welch for some time. Dozens of people were able to confirm that Walter could not have committed the murder, church members, Walter's family, and the people who were stopping at the house to buy food. That group included a police officer who stopped by the house to buy a sandwich and noted in his police log that he had bought food at Mr. McMillan's house with Walter and a crowd of church folks present. Based on their personal knowledge of Walter's whereabouts at the time of the Morrison murder, family members, church members, black pastors, and others all pleaded with Sheriff Tate to release Mr. McMillan. tape wouldn't do it. The arrest had been too long in the making to admit yet another failure. He and his investigators discussed it and agreed to stick with the accusation. Ralph Myers was beginning to have second thoughts about accusing Mr. McMillan. He, too, was being charged in the Morrison murder. In exchange for testifying against Walter, though, he had been promised that he would be favorably treated. Now it was starting to dawn on him that admitting to involvement in a high-profile murder that he actually had nothing to do with was probably not smart. A few days before the capital murder charges against Mr. McMillan were made public, Myers told the police his allegations against Mr. McMillan weren't true. At this point, Tate and his investigators had little interest in Myers denying his own story. Instead, they decided to pressure Myers to produce more incriminating details. When Myers protested that he didn't have more because, well, the story wasn't true, the investigators weren't having it. Instead, on August 1, 1987, they transferred both Myers and Walter from the county jail to death row, but on separate floors so they wouldn't interact. Death row is the most extreme, punitive confinement permitted, putting someone who has not yet had a trial into a prison reserved for convicted felons, let alone on death row, is almost never done. Even the other death row prisoners were shocked. It's unclear how Tate was able to persuade the prison warden to house two pretrial detainees on death row, although it's likely because he had connections from his days as a probation officer. Sheriff Tate drove Walter to Holman Correctional Facility, a short ride away in Atmore, Alabama. Before the trip, the sheriff again threatened Walter with racial slurs and terrifying plans. When Walter McMillan arrived on Alabama's death row, an entire community of condemned men awaited him. 100 or so death row prisoners had been sentenced to execution in Alabama since capital punishment was restored in 1975. Most of them were black, although to Walter's surprise, some were white. Everyone was poor, and everyone asked him why he was there. Condemned prisoners on Alabama's death row unit were housed in windowless concrete buildings that were notoriously hot and uncomfortable. Each death row inmate was locked in a 5-by-8-foot cell with a metal door, a commode, and a steel bunk by themselves for 23 hours a day. The temperatures in August consistently reached more than 100 degrees. Incarcerated men would trap rats, poisonous spiders, and snakes they found inside the prison to pass the time and to protect themselves. Isolated and remote, most prisoners had limited opportunity for exercise or visits and were held in disturbingly close proximity to the electric chair. The large wooden chair was built in the 1930s, and inmates had painted it yellow before attaching its leather straps and electrodes. They called it Yellow Mama. With another scheduled execution fast approaching, condemned prisoners were talking about executions constantly when Walter arrived. For his first 3 weeks on Alabama's death row, the horrifically botched execution of John Evans was pretty much all he heard about. Evans had been electrocuted 3 times over the course of 14 minutes after electrodes were incorrectly fastened by corrections officers. The circumstances of his excruciating death haunted the other inmates. The whirlwind of the past weeks had left Walter devastated. His whole life he'd been unrestrained by anyone or anything. Now he found himself confined in a way he could never have imagined. The racist taunts and threats from law enforcement officers who did not know him were shocking. He'd never experienced such contempt. He'd always been well-liked and gotten along with just about everybody. He genuinely believed the accusations against him had been a serious misunderstanding. Once officials talked to his family to confirm his alibi, he'd surely be released. When the days turned into weeks, Walter began to sink into deep despair. His body reacted to the shock of his situation. For days, he couldn't taste anything he ate. He couldn't calm himself. When he woke each morning, he would feel normal for a few minutes, and then sink into terror upon remembering where he was. Prison officials had shaved his head and all the hair from his face. Looking in a mirror, he didn't recognize himself. He was used to working outside among the trees with the scent of fresh pine on the cool breeze. Now he found himself staring at the bleak walls of death row. Fear and anguish unlike anything he'd ever experienced settled on Walter. The judge, Robert E. Lee Key, Jr., had appointed an attorney to represent Walter for his trial. But there was something untrustworthy about this white lawyer who didn't seem to have much interest in Walter's side of the story. Instead, his family raised money to hire the only black criminal lawyers in the region, J.L. Chestnut and Bruce Boynton from Selma. Chestnut was fiery. He had done a lot of civil rights work. Boynton's mother, Amelia Boynton Robinson, was a legendary activist. Boynton himself had strong civil rights credentials as well. Chestnut and Boynton failed to persuade local officials to release Walter immediately. Meanwhile, Sheriff Tate was furious that Mr. McMillan had hired outside lawyers. On the trip to Holman, he mocked Walter for thinking it would make any difference. Although the money to hire Chestnut and Boynton was raised by family members through church donations and by selling their few possessions, local law enforcement pointed to it as evidence that Walter was secretly hoarding money and that he wasn't the innocent man he pretended to be. Other prisoners had advised him to take action and file a federal complaint to fight against being illegally held on death row. When Walter, who could barely read or write, failed to file the various pleadings and lawsuits the other prisoners had advised him to file, some blamed him for his predicament. "There were days when I couldn't breathe," Walter recalled later. "I hadn't experienced anything like this before in my life. I was around all these murderers, and yet it felt like sometimes they were the only ones trying to help me. I prayed, I read the Bible, and I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I was scared, terrified just about every day." Ralph Meyer's original plan of saying he knew something about the Morrison murder had clearly backfired. He had also been charged with capital murder in the death of Rhonda Morrison and sent to death row. Myers was sinking deeper into an emotional crisis. From the time he was burned as a child, he had always feared fire, heat, and small spaces. As the prisoners talked more and more about the details of executions such as John Evans, Myers became more and more distraught. On the night of one execution, Myers was in full crisis, sobbing in his cell. There is a tradition on death row in Alabama that, at the time scheduled for the execution, the condemned prisoners bang on their cell doors with cups in protest. At midnight, while all the other prisoners banged away, Myers curled up on the floor in the corner of his cell, hyperventilating. When the stench of burned flesh that many on the row claimed they could smell during the execution wafted into his cell, Myers dissolved. He called Tate the next morning and told him that he would say whatever he wanted if he would get him off death row. Tate immediately picked up Myers and brought him back to the county jail. Ordinarily, the Alabama Department of Corrections couldn't just put people on death row or let them off without court orders or legal filings, and certainly no prison warden could do so on his own. But nothing about the prosecution of Walter McMillan was turning out to be ordinary. With Myers back as the primary witness and Bill Hooks ready to say that he saw Walter's truck at the crime scene, the DA believed that he could proceed against Mr. McMillan. The case was scheduled for trial in February 1988. The DA, Ted Pearson, was getting older and had plans to retire soon after 20 years on the job. He hated that his office had been criticized for failing to solve the Morrison murder more quickly. Pearson was determined to leave office with a victory and likely saw the prosecution of Walter McMillan as one of the most important cases of his career. His one lingering concern may have been a recent United States Supreme Court case that threatened a long-standing feature of high-profile criminal trials in the South, the all-white jury. Even 20 years after the Civil Rights Revolution, Monroe County went against legal requirements of racial integration and diversity. For example, African Americans were often excluded from jury service on felony crime cases in Monroe County. As far back as the 1880s, the Supreme Court ruled in Strouder v. West Virginia that excluding black people from jury service was unconstitutional, but juries remained all white for decades afterward. In 1945, the Supreme Court upheld a Texas statute that limited the number of black jurors to exactly one per case. In Deep South states, jury rolls were pulled from voting rolls, which excluded African Americans. Even after the Voting Rights Act passed, court clerks and judges still kept the jury rolls mostly white through various tactics to undermine the law. Local jury commissions used statutory requirements that jurors be intelligent and upright to exclude African Americans and women. By the 1970s, the Supreme Court ruled that underrepresentation of racial minorities and women in jury pools was unconstitutional. But the practice of striking all or most African American potential jurors was common. Striking, or using peremptory strikes, is a practice that allows lawyers to reject jurors without stating a reason why, which meant that defendants like Walter McMillan, even in counties that were 40 or 50% black, frequently found themselves staring at all-white juries because all the black jurors had been struck. This was especially common in death penalty cases. Then in 1986, the Supreme Court ruled in Batson v. Kentucky that prosecutors could be challenged more directly about using racially discriminatory peremptory strikes. This development gave hope to black defendants, but didn't necessarily stop prosecutors from finding loopholes to continue excluding black jurors. In cases like Walter's, which had caught the community's attention, defense lawyers will often file a motion to change venue, to move the case from the county where the crime took place to a different county where there is less publicity and eagerness to convict. Usually, though, judges reject the motion. In October 1987, Chestnut and Boynton presented a change of venue motion. To their total surprise, Pearson agreed that the trial should be moved due to the amount of pretrial coverage. Judge Key nodded sympathetically. Chestnut, who knew his way around the Alabama courts, was sure something bad was about to happen. Could the judge and the DA already have a plan? When the judge suggested that it be moved to a neighboring county so that witnesses wouldn't have far to travel, Chestnut remained hopeful. Almost all of the bordering counties had fairly large African-American populations, between 32 and 72% black. Only wealthy Baldwin County to the south was atypical, with an African-American population of just 9%. The judge took very little time deciding where the trial should be moved. We'll go to Baldwin County. The change of venue was disastrous for Walter. Chestnut and Boynton knew there would be very few, if any, black jurors. They also understood that it was an extremely conservative county that had made even less progress than Monroe in leaving behind the racial politics of Jim Crow. Chestnut and Boynton immediately complained, but the judge reminded them it was their motion. Walter worried about the venue change as well, but he still put his faith in this fact. No one could hear the evidence and believe that he committed this crime. He just didn't believe that a jury, black or white, could convict him on the nonsensical story told by Ralph Myers, not when he had an unquestionable alibi with close to a dozen witnesses. Meanwhile, Ralph Myers was once again having second thoughts. The February morning that the trial was set to begin, he told investigators that he could not testify because what they wanted him to say was not true. The trial was postponed, and Myers was sent back to death row for refusing to cooperate. Back at Holman, it wasn't long before he again showed serious emotional and psychological distress. He was sent to the Taylor Hardin Secure Medical Facility in Tuscaloosa, the state hospital for the mentally ill. It did very little to change his predicament, though, and he was returned to death row after 30 days at the hospital. Realizing he could not escape the situation he'd created for himself, Myers finally agreed, once and for all, to testify against Walter McMillan. A new trial date was scheduled for August 1988. By now, Walter had been on death row for over a year. As hard as he had tried to adjust, he couldn't accept the nightmare his life had become. His lawyer seemed happy that Myers was struggling. They told Walter it was a good sign that Myers had refused to testify. But it had meant another 6 months on death row for Walter, and he couldn't see anything encouraging about that. When they finally moved him to the Baldwin County Jail in Bay Minette for the August trial, Walter left death row confident he'd never return. He had befriended several men on the row and was surprised by how conflicted he felt about leaving them, knowing what they would soon face. Yet when they called his name to the transfer office, he lost no time getting in the van to leave. The trial was short and clinical. Jury selection lasted just a few hours. Pearson used his peremptory strikes to exclude all but one of the African Americans who had been summoned to serve on a jury. The state put Myers on the stand to tell his absurd story about Walter forcing him to drive to Jackson Cleaners. This version had Myers going into the cleaners where he saw Walter standing over the dead body of Rhonda Morrison. Bizarrely, he also claimed that a third person was present and involved in the murder, a mysterious white man with salt and pepper hair who was clearly in charge of the crime and who directed Walter to kill Myers too, but Walter couldn't because he was out of bullets. Walter thought the testimony was so nonsensical, he couldn't believe that people were taking it seriously. Why wasn't everyone laughing? Chestnut's cross-examination of Myers made it clear that the witness was lying. When Chestnut finished, Walter was sure that the state would simply announce that they had made a mistake. Instead, the prosecutor brought Myers back up to repeat his accusations, as if repeating his lies enough times would make them true. Bill Hooks testified that he'd seen Walter's truck pull out of the cleaners at the time of the murder and that he recognized the truck because it had been modified as a lowrider. Walter instantly whispered to his lawyers that he hadn't turned his truck into a lowrider until several months after Morrison was murdered. His lawyers didn't do much with that information, which frustrated Walter. Then another white man Walter had never heard of, Joe Hightower, took the stand and said that he had seen the truck at the cleaners, too. There were a dozen people who could talk about the fish fry and insist that Walter was at home when Rhonda Morrison was killed. His lawyers called only three of them. Everybody seemed to be rushing to get the trial over with, and Walter couldn't understand it. The state then called Ernest Welch, a white man, who said he was the furniture man who collected money at the McMillan house on the day they were having a fish fry. But it wasn't the same day that his niece Rhonda Morrison was murdered. He said that he had been so devastated that he went to the McMillan residence to collect money on a different day. The lawyers made their arguments, the jury retired, and less than 3 hours later, they filed back into the courtroom. Stone-faced, one by one, they pronounced Walter McMillan guilty. A week later, he sat in the van with shackles pinching his ankles and chains tightly wound around his waist. He could feel his feet beginning to swell because the circulation was cut off by the metal digging into his skin. The handcuffs were too tight, and he was becoming uncharacteristically angry. "Why you got these chains on me this tight?" The two Baldwin County deputies who had picked him up a week earlier had not been friendly on the ride from death row to the courthouse. Now that he had been convicted of capital murder, they were downright hostile. One seemed to laugh in response to Walter's question. "Them chains is the same as they were when we picked you up. They just feel tighter because we got you now." "You need to loosen this, man. I can't ride like this." "It ain't gonna happen. so you should just get your mind off it. Walter suddenly recognized the man. At the end of the trial, when the jury had found Walter guilty, his family and several of the black people who had attended the trial were in shocked disbelief. Sheriff Tate claimed that Walter's 24-year-old son, Johnny, said, "Somebody's going to pay for what they've done to my father." Tate asked deputies to arrest Johnny, and there was a scuffle. Walter saw the officers wrestle his child to the ground and place him in handcuffs. The more he looked at the two deputies driving him back to death row, the more convinced he became that one of them had tackled his son. The van began to move. They wouldn't tell Walter where he was going, but as soon as they got on the road, it was clear they were taking him back to death row. He had been distraught and confused on the day of his arrest. He had been frustrated when the days turned into weeks at the county jail. He had been depressed and terrified when they took him to death row before he was even convicted of a crime. But when the nearly all-white jury pronounced him guilty, after 15 months of waiting for vindication, he was shocked, paralyzed. Now he felt himself coming back to life, but all he could feel was seething anger. Walter realized that he had been foolish to give everyone, the prosecutors, the judge, the officers, the benefit of the doubt. "Hey, I'm going to sue all of y'all!" He knew he was screaming and that it wasn't going to make any difference. "I'm going to sue all of y'all," he repeated. The officers paid him no attention. "Loose these chains! Loose these chains!" He couldn't remember when he'd last lost control, but he felt himself falling apart. With some struggle, he became silent. Chapter 4. The Old Rugged Cross. In February 1989, Eva Ansley and I reached our goal of opening a new nonprofit law center in Tuscaloosa, dedicated to providing free, quality legal services to condemned men and women on death row in Alabama. We never thought it would be easy, but it turned out to be even harder than we had expected. Obstacles were multiplying rapidly. We were denied state funding, and after several disheartening meetings with our board, it had become clear that we had no support in the state for the project. On top of that, there weren't many lawyers who would do full-time death penalty work for less than $25,000 a year in Alabama. Eva and I realized that we would have to do it on our own and raise the money ourselves. We regrouped and started again, this time in Montgomery, the state capital. The project would eventually be named the Equal Justice Initiative, EJI. In the summer of 1989, we signed a lease on a small building near downtown Montgomery, a two-story Greek Revival house built in 1882, painted yellow and with a charming porch that made it feel open and welcoming. It felt like a good start and a nice contrast from the courtrooms, waiting rooms, and prison walls that our clients' family members had to face. The office was cold in the winter, it was almost impossible to keep squirrels out of the attic, and there wasn't enough electricity to run the copier and a coffee pot at the same time without blowing a fuse. But from the start, it felt like a home and a place to work. And given the hours we would spend there, it was always a little of both. A flood of execution dates awaited us. Between 1975, when Alabama's new death penalty statute was passed, and the end of 1988, there had been only three executions in Alabama. But by 1989, driven by shifting politics and laws, the number of people executed by the state of Alabama would double. Months before our center opened, I started visiting Alabama's death row every month, traveling from Atlanta to see a handful of new clients, including Walter McMillan. They were all grateful for the help, but as the spring of 1989 approached, they all made the same request at the end of our meetings. Help Michael Lindsay. Lindsay's execution was scheduled for May 1989. I painfully explained how limited our time and resources were and how frantic we were trying to get the new EJI office up and running. Although they said they understood, they clearly felt anguished and guilty about getting legal assistance while other men faced looming executions. Lindsay's lawyer, David Bagwell, was a respected civil attorney from Mobile. But prisoners got word of a letter Bagwell had written and talked about it among themselves, especially one chilling line. "I generally favor the death penalty because mad dogs ought to die." Many prisoners were appalled by this attitude from someone who was supposedly an advocate for them. They became even more distrustful of lawyers, even the ones who claimed to help. We decided to do what we could for Michael Lindsay, whose execution date was fast approaching. We tried to make arguments about an interesting twist in that case. His jury had never decided that he should be executed at all. He'd received a sentence of life imprisonment without parole from his jury, but the judge had overridden it, instead imposing a death sentence. This was unusual, and was likely because this judge was trying to appear tough on crime in order to get reelected. We wrote a letter to the governor of Alabama, Guy Hunt, asking him to stop the Lindsay execution on the grounds that the jury had decided against putting him to death. Governor Hunt quickly denied our request for clemency, declaring that he would not go against the wishes of the community expressed by the jury that Mr. Lindsay be put to death, even though we stressed that the community's representatives, the jury, had done the opposite. They clearly elected to spare Lindsay's life. It didn't matter. He was electrocuted on May 26, 1989. The first execution I witnessed was that of my client, Herbert Richardson, a Vietnam War veteran whose brutal, nightmarish experiences left him traumatized and scarred by post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. One of the country's least discussed post-war problems is how frequently combat veterans bring the traumas of war back with them and are incarcerated after returning to their communities. Herbert became one of thousands of combat veterans who end up in jail or prison after completing their military service. I had promised Herbert I would be with him during the execution, and when I arrived at the prison, it was completely dark. Outside the prison entrance were dozens of men with guns, state troopers, local police officers, deputy sheriffs, and what appeared to be part of a National Guard unit. It was surreal to see all of these armed men gathering near midnight to make sure a life would be taken without incident. When I got inside the visiting room, Herbert's wife and her family had less than an hour left with him to say goodbye. He was calmer than I'd ever seen him. He smiled at me when I walked in and gave me a hug. "Hey, y'all, this is my lawyer," he said, introducing me with a pride that was surprising and moving to me. I spent the next 45 minutes with one eye on the clock, knowing that soon the guards would take Herbert to the back and we would never see him alive again. When the clock struck 10 p.m., the guards dragged his weeping wife and family away with great difficulty. 30 minutes before the execution, I was brought to the cell next to the execution chamber deep inside the prison, where Herbert was being held until it was time to put him in the electric chair. They had shaved the hair off his body to facilitate a clean execution. The state had done nothing to modify the electric chair since the disastrous John Evans execution. I felt distraught. I had tried to read up on what should happen at an execution. I had some naively misguided hope that I could save Herbert if they did something incorrectly. Herbert was much more emotional when he saw me than he'd been in the visitation room. It must have been humiliating to be shaved in preparation for an execution. He looked shaken and upset. When I walked into the chamber, he grabbed my hands and asked if we could pray, and we did. When we were done, his face took on a distant look, and then he turned to me. "Hey, man, thank you. I know this ain't easy for you either, but I'm grateful to you for standing with me," he said with great emotion. I smiled and gave him a hug. His face sagged with an unbearable sadness. "It's been a very strange day, Brian, really strange. Most people who feel fine don't get to think all day about this being their last day alive with certainty that they will be killed. It's different than being in Vietnam, much, stranger. He nodded at all of the officers who were milling about nervously. It's been strange for them, too. All day long, people have been asking me, what can I do to help you? When I woke up this morning, they kept coming to me. Can we get you some breakfast? At midday, they came to me. Can we get you some lunch? All day long. What can we do to help you? Herbert sighed. More people have asked me what they can do to help me in the last 14 hours of my life than ever asked me in the years when I was coming up. He looked at me, and his face twisted in confusion. I gave Herbert one last long hug. I was reflecting on all of the trauma and difficulty that had followed this well-meaning man home from Vietnam. I couldn't help but ask myself, where were these people when he really needed them? Where were all of these helpful people when Herbert was 3 and his mother died? Where were they when he was 7 and trying to recover from physical abuse? Where were they when he was a young teen struggling with drugs and alcohol? Where were they when he returned from Vietnam, traumatized and disabled? Herbert had made a peculiar request the week before the execution. He wanted me to get the prison to play a recording of a favorite hymn as he walked to the electric chair. Now I watched an officer bring over a tape. The sad strains of "The Old Rugged Cross" began to play as they pulled Herbert away from me. There was a shamefulness about the experience I couldn't shake. Everyone I saw at the prison seemed surrounded by a cloud of regret and remorse. The prison officials had pumped themselves up to carry out the execution, but even they revealed extreme discomfort and some measure of shame. Maybe I was imagining it, but it seemed everyone recognized that what was taking place was wrong. Believing in capital punishment was one thing, but the realities of systematically killing someone who is not a threat are completely different. I couldn't stop thinking about it on the trip home. I thought about Herbert's family, about the victim's family. I thought about the visitation officer, the Department of Corrections officials, the men who were paid to shave Herbert's body so that he could be killed more efficiently. I thought about the officers who had strapped him into the chair. I kept thinking that no one could actually believe this was a good thing to do, or even a necessary thing to do. The next day, there were articles in the press about the execution. Some state officials expressed happiness and excitement that an execution had taken place. But I knew that none of them had actually dealt with the details of killing Herbert. I couldn't stop thinking that we don't spend much time contemplating the details of what killing someone actually involves. I went back to my office the next day with renewed energy. I picked up my other case files, including Walter McMillan's, and made updated plans for how to assist each client to maximize the chance of avoiding an execution. Eventually, I recognized that all of my fresh resolve didn't change much. I was really only trying to reconcile myself to the realities of Herbert's death. I was comforted by the exercise just the same. I felt more determined to recruit staff and obtain resources to meet the growing challenges of providing legal assistance to condemned people. By the end of the day, I was persuaded things would improve, even while I felt burdened by the weight of it all. Chapter 5 Homeland. Walter's wife, Minnie Bell McMillan, and his daughter Jackie were waiting patiently when I pulled up to the McMillans' dilapidated house in Repton, which was off the main road leading into Monroeville. It had been a long day. I was no longer sure what time it was. I'd spent several intense hours on death row earlier in the day with Walter going over his trial transcript. Time was critical. I should have returned to Montgomery to work on appeal pleadings, but Walter's family wanted to meet. And since they were less than an hour from the prison, I had promised to come to Monroeville. I was surprised at the profound disrepair. This was a poor family's home. The front porch was propped on 3 cinder blocks. The wood flooring showed signs of rot. The blue window frames were in desperate need of paint. The yard was littered with abandoned car parts, tires, and broken pieces of furniture. Minnie walked out the front door and apologized for the appearance of the yard as I carefully stepped onto the porch. She kindly invited me inside. "Let me fix something for you to eat. You've been at the prison all day," she said. Minnie looked tired, but otherwise appeared as patient and strong as I had imagined, based on Walter's descriptions and my own guesses from our phone conversations. Because the state had made Walter's affair with Karen Kelly part of its case in court, the trial had been especially difficult for Minnie. But she looked like she was still standing strong. "Oh no, thank you, I appreciate it, but it's fine. Walter and I ate some things on the visitation yard." "They don't have nothing on that prison yard but chips and sodas. Let me cook you something good." "That's very kind, I appreciate it, but I'm really okay. I know you've been working all day, too." "Well, yes, I'm on 12-hour shifts at the plant. Then people don't want to hear nothing about your business, your sickness, your nerves, and definitely nothing about your family problems." She didn't sound angry or bitter, just sad. She walked over to me, gently looped her arm with mine, and slowly led me into the house. We sat down on a sofa in the crowded living room. Chairs that didn't match were piled with papers and clothes. Her grandchildren's toys were scattered on the floor. "Work people tell you to be there, so you got to go." "I'm trying to get her through school, and it ain't easy." She nodded to her daughter Jackie, who looked back at her mother sympathetically. Jackie walked across the room and sat near us. Walter and Minnie had mentioned their children, Jackie, Johnny, and Boot, to me several times. Jackie's name was always followed by, "She's in college," and I had begun to think of her as Jackie, She's in College, McMillan. All of the kids were in their 20s, but still very close and protective of their mother. I told them about my visit with Walter and talked about the next steps in the case. They updated me on all the rumors in town currently circulating about the case. "I believe it was that old man Miles Jackson who done it," Minnie said emphatically. "I think it's the new owner, Rick Blair," Jackie said. "Everybody knows they found a white man's skin under that girl's fingernails where she had fought whoever killed her." As we talked, it became clear how traumatizing the last 18 months since Walter's arrest had been. "The trial was the worst," Minnie said. "They just ignored what we told them about Johnny D being home. Nobody has explained to me why they did that. Why did they do that?" She looked at me as if she honestly hoped I could provide an answer. "The trial was constructed with lies," I said. I was cautious about expressing such strong opinions to Walter's family because I hadn't investigated the case enough yet. But reading the record of his trial had outraged me, not just about the injustice done to Walter, but also about the way it had burdened the entire community. Everyone in the poor black community who talked to me about the case had expressed hopelessness. "One lie after the other," I continued. "People were fed so many lies that by the time y'all started telling the truth, it was just easier to believe you were the ones who were lying. It frustrates me to even read it in the trial record, so I can only imagine how you all feel." The phone rang, and Jackie jumped up to answer it. She came back a few minutes later. "Eddie said that people are getting restless. They want to know when he's going to be there." Minnie stood up and straightened her dress. "Well, we should probably get going. They've been waiting most of the day for you." When I looked confused, Minnie smiled. "Oh, I told the rest of the family we would bring you down there, since it's so hard to find where they live if you've never been there before. His sisters, nephews, nieces, and other folks all want to meet you." I followed their directions down a long, winding dirt road full of impossible turns through a heavily wooded area. We came to a short, narrow bridge with room for only one car to pass. It looked shaky and unstable, so I slowed the car to a stop. "It's okay. It hasn't rained that much, and that's the only time when it's really a problem," Minnie said. "What kind of problem?" I didn't want to sound scared, but we were in the middle of nowhere, and in the pitch black night I couldn't tell whether it was a swamp, a creek, or small river under the bridge. "It will be all right. People drive through here every day," Jackie chimed in. It would have been too embarrassing to turn around, so I drove slowly across the bridge and was relieved when we made it to the other side. The forest began to give way to trailers, a few small homes, and finally an entire community hidden away in the woods. We pulled up a hill until we reached a trailer that was glowing in the darkness, lit by a fire burning in a barrel out front. Small children were playing outside. They dashed into the trailer when they saw our car pull up. As we got out of the car, a tall man greeted us. He hugged Minnie and Jackie before shaking my hand. "They've been waiting for you," he told me. "I know you probably got a lot of work to do, but we appreciate you coming to meet with us. I'm Giles, Walter's nephew." Giles led us inside. The small home was packed with more than 30 people, whose chattering fell silent when I entered. One by one, they started to smile at me. Then, to my amazement, the room broke into loud applause. I was stunned by the gesture. No one had ever applauded me just for showing up. There were older women, younger women, men Walter's age, several men much older. Their faces were creased with worry. When the applause had died down, I began to speak. "Thank you, that's very kind," I started. "I'm so glad to meet you all. Mr. McMillan told me he had a large family, but I didn't expect so many of you to be here. I saw him today, and he wants me to pass along his thanks and his gratitude to all of you for sticking by him. I hope you know how much your support means. He has to wake up on death row every morning, and that's not easy. But he knows he's not alone. He talks about you all the time." "Sit down, Mr. Stevenson," someone shouted. I took a seat on an empty couch that seemed to have been reserved for me, and Minnie sat down beside me. "We don't have any money. We gave it all to the first lawyer," called out one of the men. "I understand that, and I won't take a penny. I work for a non-profit law office, and we provide legal assistance at no cost to the people we represent," I replied. "Well, how do you pay the bills?" asked one young woman. People laughed at the question. "We get donations from foundations and people who support our work." An older woman spoke up. It was Armilla Hand, Walter McMillan's older sister. "We don't have much, Mr. Stevenson, but you have someone we love in your care. Anything we have, you have. These people have broken our hearts," she said. The family shared questions and comments about Walter, the town, race, the police, the trial, and the way the whole family was now being treated by people in the community. There seemed to be therapeutic relief in voicing their concerns to me. I began to feel encouraged that some of the information I provided maybe eased their anxiety. We started to joke some, and before I knew it, I felt embraced in a way that energized me. An older woman had given me a tall glass of sweet iced tea, and no matter how much or how little I drank, she minded my glass religiously the entire evening. As our conversation continued, Armilla Hand again spoke up. "We were standing next to him that whole morning. We know where he was. We know what he was doing." Her voice grew louder and more distraught. The crowd in the small trailer hummed in agreement. It was the kind of wordless testimony of struggle and anguish I'd heard all the time growing up in a small rural black church. "Just about everybody in here was standing next to him, talking to him, laughing with him, eating with him. Then the police come along months later, say he killed somebody miles away, at the same time we're standing next to him. Then they take him away when you know it's a lie." She was now struggling to speak. Her hands were trembling, and the emotion in her voice was making it hard for her to get her words out. "We were with him all day. What are we supposed to do, Mr. Stevenson? Tell us, what are we supposed to do with that?" Her face twisted in pain. "I feel like I've been convicted, too." The small crowd responded to each statement with shouts of yes, and that's right. "I feel like they'd put me on death row, too. What do we tell these children about how to stay out of harm's way when you can be at your own house, minding your own business, surrounded by your entire family, and they still put some murder on you that you ain't do, and send you to death row. I sat on the crowded sofa in my suit, staring into the face of a lot of